Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. I think it's been about 5 or 6 years since we've had our guest on the show. And fascinating guy. I'm kicking myself for not having brought him back sooner. But this seems like the perfect time. He released a book this past February called Black Swan Ghosts. A sociologist encounters witnesses to unexplained aerial craft, their occupants, and other elements of the multiverse. And he poses the question, what happens when you come into contact with a phenomenon so controversial that it can destroy your career? Well, Black Swan Ghosts is an investigation into how our society treats witnesses to unexplained events, unidentified aerial objects, and mysterious beings. So joining us now, after way too long a time, Dr. Simeon Hine. Dr. Hine, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave. Thanks for having me again.
Great topic and concept for this book. Let's start with a little bit of your background for listeners that are new and coming on to us and just finding the show. Talk to me a little bit about your background and into this research, how you got involved.
Well, I initially started with a kind of a conventional background, like, you know, in college.
Okay.
Graduate school, you know, assistant professorships and stuff like that. And, you know, I just thought I was going to go into academics and, you know, get a PhD and teach and, you know, do the things that you were taught to do. We're so conditioned from the time we're really small, right?
Right.
It starts in kindergarten. They get you in kindergarten, I'm telling you, with this kind of idea of what your life plan is supposed to be, right? And we all grow up with this idea as kids, oh, I'm going to be this or an astronaut or right. a doctor, right? And when you start getting into higher education, they really drill that idea into you, like you're going to be a specialist in this area or that area, right? And, you know, you can't just be a doctor anymore. I mean, you got to focus on one specialty most of the time. Unless you're one of those nurse practitioners, they do a great job, by the way. But, you know, people are really specialized, even astronauts. And so as you go farther along, you think you know what you're going to do. And I was in sociology. I got a PhD in sociology. I was studying something that did truly interest me, which is how we interact with technology. You know, how does technology change our lives? How does it, you know, how does society evolve differently as technology gets more and more complex? The fact that we can even, you know, communicate the way we are right now, it's amazing. But I often always wondered, like, what does that do to the rest of our lives in terms of our way we connect to, you know, other people, nature, things like that. And that's really what I was focused on, and I also was good at statistics. So I really thought I knew what I was going to be doing until I came across something called remote viewing. And I was listening to my local community radio station one night, just happened to turn it on here in Boulder, Colorado. And there was this guy named Dr. Courtney Brown, and he was talking about something called remote viewing. And what this was, allegedly, was this idea that people can perceive things at a distance without using their physical senses. In other words, using some sort of psychic ability, which he claimed everyone had, that you could get information about things you could never get any other way from any conventional means. And moreover, the government had had a secret program in this for 20 years, and they had trained even ordinary people how to be psychic and get very specific information, even going back in time, going into the future, going across the galaxy. He wrote this book. It was called Cosmic Voyage. So I actually was kind of incredulous. I just thought, I just can't believe this is true. I mean, I know there may be special psychic people. You've seen them on TV or something, working with the police or something like that. But I didn't think I could do it. And so I went to the bookstore a couple days later, looked for this book, Cosmic Voyage. I put it back on the shelf. I was going to leave it there. I looked at it. I said, this is kind of boring. I was walking out of the bookstore, the Boulder bookstore. And this little voice in my head just kind of told me to go back and get the book, you know, and spend the $25 hardcover. And kind of like, if this is true, it's a big deal. So I read the book. There was a number at the back of the book. It said, if you want training, call this 800 number and you can be in our next class. So I called the number, kind of partly, Dave, as a skeptic. I mean, not necessarily saying that I was sold on it, but I'd read the book. He talked about viewing historical targets in the past, different kind of everyday targets of mountains and buildings in the present, and even looking at extraterrestrial types of subjects. And the thing about Courtney, I got to tell you, which lends some credibility to the whole topic, was that he had a PhD like I did. I was interested in chaos theory, nonlinear dynamics, you know, the way things don't interact in ways you'd expect. And he was doing this in political science. So there was a kind of vibe there, like a connection, and he had some credibility with me for that reason. So when I was done with the book, I said, I gotta find out more about this. And I ended up being in his second or third class in remote viewing back in 1996, May 1996.
Now, are you still going into it with the approach that this is, you're being a skeptic, you don't really believe this is going to happen, but you're trying to, because I wonder, how do you crack that shell of being open but going into it with a skeptical mind? That's one of the issues I have when I visit haunted locations. Sometimes I'm afraid the reason I didn't have an experience is I was too skeptical of the site to begin with.
Right. I mean, it's something to be aware of, and that can limit your experience, but it doesn't seem to limit anyone's experience in remote viewing. It seemed almost as if, and the people who developed this at Stanford Research Institute, Hal Puthoff, Russell Targ, with natural psychics like Ingo Swann and Pat Price, what they found is that the more skeptical someone was, the better viewer they became. And so it didn't seem to matter. Courtney told us that this technique was so robust that if it didn't work, it was his fault. Just follow the instructions. It worked in any situation. It was designed for the battlefield because it came out of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And it was declassified in 95. The protocols were never classified, so anybody could teach them. But the particular things that they did with it were classified until, 95 or so, when Congress kind of did a review of it. They concluded it didn't work, by the way, but that's very controversial. They only looked at a very limited number of sessions and so forth. But when I went into it, I'll tell you why, Dave. Because when you go through academia, you are trained to be skeptical of everything, even your own ideas. It's just part of the academic process. The academic process teaches you that there has to be some sort of empirical results that correspond to your ideas, some sort of data, something that you could measure that would show you that your ideas about the way you think the world works actually correspond to reality. That's our newer idea of science. It didn't always exist. It took people like Galileo to really hammer it in. At the time, 500 years ago, people didn't think that facts mattered. It was just what the church said, what Aristotle had said, and so forth. But our modern idea of science, about 500 years old, at least it started back then, was that things have to correspond to data, to actual results, right? We all understand this because this is how we're brought up nowadays, but people didn't always act this way. So I had both an open mind to it that it could be real. I mean, I didn't know everything, I'm just a sociology, graduate. I was open to the idea it could be real, and I just thought I'm going to give it my best shot, but I kind of doubt it. That's how I went into it.
That seems fair enough and a good grasp. But the book at least grabbed your attention enough, and everything that you were able to glean from that was enough to make you realize there's a good possibility there's something much more going on here than just imaginations or you know, any other kind of false ideas or witness, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you see any flaws in the reading? Did you see anything that stood out to you that you were like, this part is the part I can't buy. This is the part that science and what I know of history just isn't a possibility.
Yeah, there was a lot of it that seemed, according to my rational way of thinking, that I didn't understand how it could possibly work. In the book, Courtney goes through a lot of his remote viewings that he did with one of the military guys, who he didn't mention in the book for legal reasons. He just mentioned it was his monitor and someone who had trained him. And it's done blind, which means you aren't told anything about the target until you're done. And this is how it's been taught for a long time and tested, even double blind. Double blind would be the viewer doesn't know the target, the monitor doesn't know the target. And maybe it was selected by a computer, the target, or some random way, at least in, we're talking about the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so they're controls, the way any scientific experiment would have controls built in so that your expectations don't contaminate the results. Now, obviously, expectations do matter, and my belief now is that it's important to know your expectations because that's sort of, in a sense, kind of what can create your reality. But scientifically, you're supposed to leave your personal beliefs out of the experiment. So Courtney had done a lot of different sessions in this book, famous historical events, the first time the Wright brothers were able to successfully fly and what caused the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, assassination of JFK, things like that. And also control targets where it's just a famous landmark like the Eiffel Tower or Mount Kilimanjaro or something like this, where you know that it's going to be accurate if you got the results. In other words, you can compare your results to something known. But there are a lot of targets where they're unknowns, and that's really what you're using it for eventually. So the protocol that Courtney used was scientifically based. He even called it scientific remote viewing. The military guys had called it coordinate remote viewing or controlled remote viewing, CRV. And Courtney changed the name to SRV. And other people have come up with different RV names, TRV, and there are all sorts of other RVs. But it's all really the same thing. And in this system, you aren't told anything about the target ahead of time. You're working with random numbers. So basically, you're given some random coordinates that are also written on an envelope or a folder that contains the particular target that you're supposed to describe.
Well, that if I could ask one thing, Dr. Hyman, what about the layman like me? I have no idea. If you set down a set of coordinates in front of me, I wouldn't understand what I'm even looking at, let alone how to use my mind to track that. Does that work as a wall against you as part of the experiment as well?
Well, that's the interesting thing, Dave. There is no way you can connect random coordinates to anything that in our rational world that you and I have been taught to believe in. Random numbers are random. There's no information there. That's what random means. It's not. It's
right. But even if you gave me a targeted site that they knew what this was, it wasn't random. If you laid any kind of coordinates in front of me, it would mean nothing to me. 32 degrees north by 42 degrees longitude.
Exactly.
That means nothing in my world. So I would just look at it as a series of numbers. And is that how you were, or were you understanding of how that worked on a map and how to figure out coordinates?
No, you're not figuring out anything.
Okay,
that's
good.
You are not supposed to know what's going on.
Okay.
It's another part of your mind. That's
interesting. Okay.
You could call it the unconscious. You could call it the collective unconscious, supermind, the quantum mind, whatever you want to call it. It's another mind that we have. It's a dreaming mind. We all are familiar with this mind when we dream at night. There doesn't seem to be a logic to it in the same way that there's a logic when we're awake, right? It's different rules. And this is the same thing. You're given these random numbers. Your conscious mind does not know what in the world those are because they're random. So you can't try to figure it out. So your conscious mind has to give up. And that's also one of the purposes of these random coordinates is you don't know what's going on. You have to trust something else within yourself, some other source of intuition that can connect to the target site without the help of your conscious mind. And that's the leap that was very difficult for me to make initially. And it's challenging for most people because you and I are brought up to believe there has to be a linear sequence of events to get from A to Z. You have to go from A to B to C to D to E, right? That's how we're taught in school. You have to show the teacher how you came up with your answer. You can't just say, I have this answer, right? Except in music and art and things like that. Otherwise, in math and science and even language, there's rules of grammar. You have to be able to justify what you're doing. Not so in remote viewing. The fact, the more confused you are, the better it works. So going back to your question a few minutes ago, even if you're totally skeptical, it doesn't matter because that's not the part of your mind that's doing it. It's another part of your mind. And the only rule, the only one rule you have to follow during an RV session is do not edit anything out, which means whatever comes across your mind's eye in the course of that 20 minutes, half an hour, an hour, however long you're doing the session, you have to write it down somewhere on the page. Now, you know some of it is going to be things that you're just making up, that your conscious mind is trying to figure it out and grasp at. But some of it is actually the signal. The signal from the actual target site is really faint. And that's what the training involves, in a nutshell. Learning to pay attention to the most subtle types of sensations you have while you're doing the session, the most fleeting sort of glimpses that you have in your mind of the target. And the solid 3D stuff is usually noise that you're making up on top of the signal. So it's a process of separating out the signal from the noise. And our conscious minds are really noisy places, right? So you're spending that time when impressions come across your mind and you're attempting just to let things come across your mind with the intention of describing the target site as best you can. Not defining it. You're not saying what you think it is. You don't have to do that. It's just describe it. Very low-level description, colors, sounds, textures, shapes, patterns, things like that. You may not know what the target is. In fact, most of the time you'll never know what it is, but you could still describe it accurately. I mean, if I gave you something and you couldn't see it, you could still describe the feeling of it. You may not know exactly what it is. Or you may get the colors of something and the smells right, but you wouldn't know exactly what you're dealing with. And that's sort of how it works. You're dealing with lower level impressions, not conclusions. So essentially, you're sort of separating how your mind works. You're becoming very aware of how your mind works. Part of it wants to figure things out, right? It's how we're trained. It's the linear, rational, analytical mind. And then the other part of our mind, what's called the right brain, and there's that book Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain by Betty Edwards, which is based on the same idea. It's partly where they got this technique from. It's more holistic and contextual, and it doesn't see things in terms of definitions. It sees things in terms of descriptions. So it doesn't say what the thing is, but it's very good at describing what it might be used for, what it feels like, and so forth. And it's called the bicameral brain. The left brain does different things than the right brain. And a good remote viewer learns how to separate out left brain information from right brain information. So everyone is familiar with this in some sense because we all have intuitions about people, places, and things we encounter every day, right? And sometimes those intuitions are pretty strong, and we can't justify why we feel that way about a person, place, or event. But sometimes we even act on it without knowing why. And that's sort of like RV. It's just a lot fainter than that because it's not something that really necessarily matters to you. It's a distant place or location, and maybe it has nothing directly to do with your life. So nature says you don't need to know too much about that. I'm not going to give you a lot of signal strength. But if it's a situation in your life where something's about to happen in an hour, or there's going to be a significant event in your family or something, you can sometimes get intuitions about it ahead of time. Have you ever talked to someone, Dave? There was something, a big event in their family, and they just had the feeling to pick up the phone and call.
Right.
Yeah,
yes, I've had that happen, sure.
Sure. So that's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's just developing that more so you could use it for different sorts of information, not just things that are related to you directly.
All right. So once you've got a grasp of this and you start doing it and you're skeptical and all of a sudden your mind is unleashed, Dr. Hein, and you start to have these experiences and you realize that you were picking up on aspects of these targets, how did that affect your thinking and your paradigm, your life understandings?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question because, you know, the first 3 days in Courtney's class, he doesn't teach the classes anymore, but at the time, you know, he did back in the 90s. But the Farside Institute still exists, by the way. I'm actually, I have to, disclaimer, I'm on the board of directors now of Courtney's. Just some people know, I have something to do. I still am, communicate with Courtney and his Farside Institute. He has a YouTube channel. You know, I have a YouTube channel. Everyone has a YouTube channel now, but he, you know, you can see it, but he doesn't teach it, but there's demonstrations you can see online. But at the time, it was an 8-day training class. The first couple days, I didn't see much of a connection between what I'd drawn on the page and, you know, what the actual target turned out to be. But by the third day, I got some really good results. And one of them was a picture. The target was a picture of Cancun, Mexico on the beach with the hotels in the background. And during the session, I had heard people speaking Spanish. It felt like a, you know, warm climate. There was water. And then when I looked at my sketch, that was the real shocker. I had reproduced the target picture. I mean, everything, every little detail was in the picture. And at the time, when you're drawing these, sketches for an RV session, you don't know, you know, what you're doing. You're just letting your hand move almost automatically. But all the hotel buildings were there, the water, even these little rocks, people on the beach, it all fit. And it was rather shocking. And there, you know, there was a part of my mind that I don't think wanted it to work, because when you grow up a certain way and you reach a certain age, you know, and I took this RV class, you know, I was like my late 20s. So you're thinking, you know how the world works. There's a part of your mind that thinks it's figured things out by the time you reach a certain age. Certainly by the time, yeah, by the time you have a PhD, you think, I know how the world works, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an assistant professor. Yeah. Well, wrong. You don't know how it works. Okay. So this is big lesson number one. You don't know what's going on. You think you know what's going on, but you don't. And those RV exercises are excellent at showing you, there's more going on in your awareness than you know. And these types of things proved it to me. There was the Cancun session. There was a couple more. And everyone in the class, there were about 10 people in the class, everyone had some sort of contact during that week. And it blows you away because you don't know how you just did such a perfect session. You don't know how you did it. But there it is. The colors, the sounds. Now, skeptics would say, well, sure, once in a while you're going to get a perfect one. But the odds are of doing that are like 1 out of 1,000. I mean, the target could be anything, literally anything. So if you did it just after 5 sessions or 10 or something like that, that means you really made some target contact. It's very unlikely that it was random. And all the statistical results often show the same thing, that you're just simply getting more information than you should be getting if you're just using your physical senses. In other words, Dave, you know, there's a subterranean channel in our awareness. I'm not saying brain deliberately. It's more than our brain. It's brain has something to do with it. But in our consciousness and unconsciousness, there's another channel of information that picks up what we call non-local information. The local information is stuff like in the room right around you right now, whatever you see, that's local. And non-local would be things that are distant, that are not being picked up directly by your senses. I mean, way out of the range. And
so would that fall in the realm of, as a perfect example in my life recently, about 2.5-3 weeks ago, I just had this overwhelming desire to get in touch with an old friend of mine from high school.
Yeah.
And I started trying to research any way to find his phone numbers. I looked online. I found some numbers that were no longer good. I couldn't find an email. I couldn't find his Facebook anymore. I was looking everywhere. And spent the better part of a day just trying to track this friend down, tried contacting other old friends that might know contact. Nobody was able to find him. And then I think it was within a week, I get an email from his sister on Facebook that says, I just thought I should let you know, Wally died of cancer last night.
Right.
And none of us knew that he had it. He'd been hiding it from the family and passed away yesterday. And I was like, what? And out of all of this time to suddenly have this overwhelming need and desire to contact a friend who I haven't spoken to in 12 years was very strange to me. But is that same kind of connection, that weird interaction from a distance, right?
That's it. I'm sure a lot of our audience has had something like that happen too.
Right.
I had it happen once with a dog that I had as a pet, and I went away for 3 months to work in a research institute in Austria, right? So I gave the dog to someone I knew, another graduate student who had lived on a farm up in northeastern Washington State. And you know what happened is they got really attached to the dog after 3 months, especially the kid. So I let them have the dog for a while, but eventually I felt, you know, I should, it's really my dog. I should get the dog back. And I kept, this overwhelming feeling kept coming over me. And I was about to pick up the phone, and then it rang, and it was this woman. And the dog had passed away from some unknown reason.
Wow.
You know. But the feeling right before that was so strong, like every day, it kept growing. The same sort of thing you're talking about, though, right? I mean, I hadn't talked to them in a couple of weeks, and all of a sudden this feeling came over me. I needed to contact them, find out about the dog. And then they called me, right? So a lot of people have had experiences like that.
Right.
And it's because we're connected to these people. There's a resonance. There's a vibe between you two, right? So, yeah, that's the same thing.
Well, you would think, but it's been, like I said, it's been almost 12 years since we've even chatted. And from that point, it was probably, you know, probably a total of almost 25 years since we've been friends and kept in any kind of contact. So that was what was weird to me, is that there is still that lingering connection.
Yeah,
there is still that weird.
That is a long time.
Yeah.
It's a long time, but it just shows you still had a connection.
Right.
Or it wouldn't have showed up on your radar.
Dr. Hein, the name of the book is called Black Swan Ghosts. Explain that title to our listeners so that they understand that we're not talking about Natalie Portman here, but what exactly are Black Swan Ghosts?
Well, let me just, before I describe Black Swan Ghosts, let me tell you where it kind of, it sort of came from.
Sure.
Because my first book, yeah, let's just go back to what we're talking about, and I'll tell you how I got into Black Swan Ghosts, right? So the RV thing, you know, was really shocking.
Remote viewing, worked. Just for our listeners that may not have been paying attention. RV, remote viewing, right.
Yeah, and so it's kind of like a gateway drug to other things, because when you come in contact with remote viewing, you begin to wonder what else is real.
Right.
Right.
That you weren't told about. And as it happened, a lot of I ended up becoming a teacher at Courtney's Farsight Institute for about a year or so in 96, 97. And there were a number of people that showed up there who talked about the UFO ET phenomena. And they were credible people. They had people that had worked with NASA. People that had worked in photography, film, video with NASA, who said that there were structures on the moon that they had seen in the photos that they had worked with and the videotapes. I mean, very clear structures that we weren't being shown. There was another guy that showed up there who had been an astronaut in the shuttle program, and he talked about different types of reverse engineered craft, you know, these triangular craft and things like this. But then he said that the government hadn't invented them. They were just reverse engineering it the best they could from allegedly extraterrestrial craft. So that was really my kind of first contact with the subject, you know, since graduate school. So I wrote a book about it. Crop circles came into it also, because Courtney had us remote view crop circles. See, once you start viewing ordinary targets, you can move on, as you were saying, to non-ordinary targets, historical targets, and even kind of anomalous targets where you don't really know exactly what's going on. You're going to use RV to move the viewer around in space and time to see if you can figure out, like kind of like a psychic detective, what's going on.
Right. Right.
And so anyway, it was all quite extraordinary. I ended up writing a book about it called Opening Minds, you know, A Journey of Extraordinary Encounters, Crop Circles, and Resonance. You know, it's on Amazon. It's been a big seller over the years. And it was a kind of really realizing that our minds are not totally open. Even mine hadn't been open to the idea that remote viewing could be real for the average person. And yet I found out that it really worked. So what I didn't count on, Dave, is that even though, you know, these topics do open your mind up to new ideas about how the universe could work, who you are, you know, once you begin questioning one thing, you actually start questioning the whole thing.
Right.
Because you realize, well, if you take one brick out, you know, okay, well, what about the next brick? Eventually the wall starts falling down if you take the bricks out. And you realize that your view of reality was not wrong. It was just limited. And that is something that, you know, most people are not accustomed to really challenging once they become an adult, because they spend all these years becoming whatever they are, right? And you don't want to deconstruct that now, but I had no choice, because here I had seen that remote viewing worked. There were some sort of principles involved that I didn't thoroughly understand. And the data showed that it worked. The review for Congress, you know, Jessica Utz, who's a, you know, high-level statistician from the University of California. She concluded it worked. Everyone basically looked at the data, concluded the data show it worked. There wasn't necessarily a good explanation of how and why, but basically you get about, you know, somewhere on the order of about 25% more information than you would if you were just guessing consistently, test after study after study. So what I didn't count on, Dave, is that maybe people don't want to open their minds, right? I mean, I had called the book Opening Minds, and I just assumed that people would be fascinated by these topics and want to delve into them. And there are obviously a lot of people that who are, like the listeners of this show, to just mention a few, right?
Right.
And thanks to them for having an open mind and people that are willing to – because it's not the easiest thing to do. So here's what happened, Dave. I ended up encountering more and more people who had had some sort of unexplained experience with UFOs, extraterrestrials, things like that. And they would always tell me about it because they felt as someone that was involved with remote viewing. You know, after working with Courtney, I set up my own institute here in Boulder to teach people remote viewing. We had classes for a long time. We'll be doing some again next year. And I encountered more and more people, and I began to go to conferences, different conferences that were related to remote viewing, often UFO conferences. There's an overlap there. People who have had UFO experiences often have psychic impressions from the event, you know, psychic repercussions almost, you could say. They feel like they're more psychic afterwards. In some cases, Dave, even before they have the encounter, they start noticing strange things. I'm sure you're aware of this.
Right, definitely.
So it's very complex and nonlinear, just like remote viewing was, which makes it all the more fun. But I had to realize that I didn't really totally know what was going on anymore. I mean, you could describe this stuff statistically because, you know, I used to teach that, but that doesn't tell you necessarily what's happening there. So I encountered more and more people that had had these encounters, but they didn't want to talk about it. And then the sociologist in me kind of kicked in after like two decades there. It's like, what is it about us that we don't want to really look at the facts if they're inconvenient facts? What is it about us that's afraid of what our neighbors are going to think, you know, our employers? Why are people afraid even to talk about these topics?
Right.
Especially the UFO topic. And that's where Black Swan Ghosts came out of. Because I realized I had encountered about 15 people or so. Well, more. But some of them would let me write about the stories they had told me. I mean, initially, Dave, a lot of these people who've had encounters or whose parents were in the military will tell you something and tell you never to talk about it again.
Right.
Right.
A lot of people like this. I'm not kidding. Their dad maybe was a little drunk one night and started talking about something they saw at the base and then kind of came back from that and said, don't ever mention it again or something like that. Or they signed something, the dad signed something, or the wife saying, I'll never talk about it again. So I mean, can encounter people like this, people who were very open sharing their experiences with me, people we met on the Crop Circle tour. I've been since going over there to find out what crop circles were because of Courtney's remote viewing targets in 97. I started going over there. What are these crop circles? I actually got so interested, I went on tours, and now I give tours to the crop circles. But we met some very interesting people over there over the years who'd had very good, very close-up encounters. Let us videotape them. And I decided to assemble this book of all these different witness stories of people who told me their stories. And I'm just one person, and I wasn't even looking for the stories. You got to understand, I'm not a UFO investigator. I don't go out looking for these stories. These were stories that came to me year after year. The witnesses got more and more credible, more people who worked at NASA who said that there was a cover-up. And you begin to put two and two together, and you realize 2 + 2 is starting to equal 5, you know,
right.
Because something is going on that we're not being told about. You wouldn't have – you just would not have all these people you randomly meet in life with these very credible stories with multiple witnesses. And then more people from NASA, more people who had worked in the intelligence agencies coming forward to tell you things. And then you start getting stories that the people really ask you never to repeat.
Let's cover that when we return. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
beyond the darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Today we're talking with our guest, Dr. Simeon Hine. He poses a question in his book, what happens when you come into contact with a phenomenon so controversial that it can destroy your career? His book is called Black Swan Ghosts, A Sociologist's Encounters, Witnesses to Unexplained Aerial Craft, Their Occupants, and Other Elements of the Multiverse. I've had people for the last 12 years of doing the show. I'll be on a plane. It could be any race, color, creed, and they'll ask me, oh, where are you going? What are you doing? And I tell them I'm on my way to a conference. What type of conference? I always swallow a little hard when I'm about to say a paranormal conference. And I'll get the same response 90% of the time where they kind of do that little nervous, huh, okay. And then they turn away. And then a few seconds later, they go, do you really believe in all that stuff? And I say, well, I'm interested in it. I'm fascinated in researching it. I've had my own experiences, but I'm still skeptical of the nature of a lot of this. And I think we do make mistakes that appear to be paranormal. But so we chatted a little bit about that. But almost every time after they kind of scoff and roll their eyes, they'll go, well, I'm not really a believer. I don't know. But then I always get, but I did have this one experience.
Yeah, right.
And it's crazy. And you listen to these guys, and you were talking about how you had some military and NASA people that have come forward to talk to you, but you're not allowed to talk about it. We were talking about the phenomena of black-eyed kids, this really weird, almost sounds too urban legend to be true. And I started hearing from military personnel that were stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they were telling me how they would, on occasion, encounter these black-eyed children and what would happen before and after these encounters. And in most cases, they would always show up around the time of violent deals. And they had to be very careful. They're like, Dave, you don't know. These kids could be strapped with bombs. You have to be leery of even letting them come near you. And he said, but when you get in there, you're talking to them, and they're acting weird. Their eyes are completely black, no whites. That would weird us out more than the enemy we were there to fight. It was just bizarre to hear these stories, but then they would always tell me the same thing, but you can't tell who I am or where I had this experience. And they would give me specifics of where they would see these encounters and what would happen. And I said, well, if this is happening, why aren't you talking about it? Or, you know, he goes, because a lot of these incursions, these moments of tragedy happen, and they're not even covering those in the news.
Yeah.
So that to me was a shocking moment. But yeah, here you've got a lot of people that come forward that want to tell you things from real experiences, but you've got to do it off the record. And that's tough because, boy, would that make this field a lot easier for people to start to swallow if you had a groundswell of people in the know able to share these encounters and you realize that we're not, this isn't a limited thing to just a small subsect of the country or the planet, right? That there is something bigger happening.
It's people have had these experiences. You mention what you do on a plane, and then someone will say, you know, I did have this experience, and they'll tell you. But they won't tell other people in their lives because we're all afraid of being ostracized.
Right.
It's a deep unconscious fear, you know, in mammals to be pushed out of the group. So it prevents us from really talking about these experiences, and then science tells us it's not real. There's a lot of disincentives to bring it up, not to mention government disinformation campaigns in the past that told people it was just weather balloons and things like this. You know, the black swan idea actually comes from a book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, The Black Swan.
Right.
He's using it more just as a little background here. In just kind of in society and economics, that there are events that are very rare that we're not prepared for. Because they happen so rarely, we don't even know how to talk about them. That's kind of the idea of the black swan. It's something that's very improbable that could really change things a lot if it happened. But because it's so infrequent, we really even don't bring it up very much. We don't even consider it as a possibility in our day-to-day lives. But these black swan events do, you know, floods. Very destructive hurricanes and the credit crash that we had in 2008, 2009, right? And so those are black swan events. But what I call black swan ghosts are also rare events, but because of the biases of our society that considers them not to be real, they're ghostly because we don't even talk about them with each other, right? You wouldn't mind talking about the possibility of a flood, right, or economic crash. I mean, people talk about these things from time to time.
Yes, sometimes
too often,
right.
So there's a language to talk about it. And no one's going to think you're weird if you talk about the next flood. I mean, it could be rare. It could be something that never happened. But you won't be seen as like being too weird if you bring it up a lot. If you kept bringing – if you were preoccupied with a really rare event, then people are going to start seeing you as kind of weird, you know. And but it'll be kind of acceptable with something that seems conceivable as real. But what about things that you and I are interested in, UFOs and hauntings and ghosts and remote viewing, events that don't happen to people that often, ghost sightings, unless you go out to look for them or you live in a haunted house, you know, with a poltergeist. But if you have experiences like this, but there's no real easy way to talk about it, and you're afraid that you'll be ostracized, it to me becomes a black swan ghost event, which really has a possibility for causing societal upset because it's not even on the radar as being possible. You know, the black swan event could be highly improbable, but possible. But the black swan ghost event is like a lot of people would consider it impossible. And that's where we are with UFOs. Whatever you want to call them, UAPs, what people are calling them nowadays, anomalous aerial vehicles. So we don't have a language to talk about, and we're afraid that if we do talk about it, people will think we're weird. So, you know, like what you're talking about is mentioning this stuff on when you're on a plane going to a paranormal conference, right?
Right.
So in any case, that's why I called it Black Swan Ghost, because a lot of these people – who I interviewed in the book had never really talked to anybody about this before because they didn't even know how. They were just happy that there was someone like me who was willing to listen who wouldn't judge them, right? And so like one of these women in the book, she her name was Louise Vovez. She passed away a couple years ago after our interview. And she was picking huckleberries with her brother up in a remote area in northeastern Washington on the border of Idaho, Usk, Washington. A couple people were up there picking huckleberries too. Her brother made huckleberry pies and things like that for a living. And there's a huckleberry season. So they're up there picking huckleberries. All of a sudden this disc shows up over the huckleberry area. And a couple people, a mom and a son, panic and call, leave, get out of there. It's just hovering over them in that kind of falling leaf pattern, you know, kind of back and forth. And calls the sheriff, goes down, finds a phone, calls the sheriff, and then the sheriff calls the military, and all these military trucks come up from Spokane and seal the area off. And Louise said before the craft left, it went right over the meadow. It made a whooshing sound and flattened all the plants, just like we've heard from crop circles. So here's a witness who saw something that's kind of crop circle-like. I mean, it didn't happen in wheat. And it wasn't really a very coherent pattern. It was just kind of flattened as it left. But it still was flattened plants, right? And in any case, she told me back then we didn't even have the word UFO in our vocabulary. And I don't think she talked to this very many people. She mentioned it to a friend of mine, Joy French, who also had an encounter, who's also in the Black Swan Ghost book, who had some missing time on Mount St. Helens with a friend as they're driving there, lost about 8 hours of time. Some very bright lights came overhead. All of a sudden, they lose 8 hours of time. But she had talked to Joy, but she hadn't talked to many people. So she told me the interview's up on the website, blackswanghost.com. I'll just mention that. I put all the interviews up for free so people can watch them that are part of the book. And so here's one of these witnesses, great witness. You know, you can tell she's telling the truth. And she described it as this kind of two tortoise shells put together with lights in between, you know, the classic UFO. The military comes up, seals the area off. They're doing soil tests, and they couldn't even get back in there a week later to keep picking huckleberries. It was still sealed off. They put jeeps a mile away from the site. Really something. So you kind of, what is going on here? So these are types of events that are part of our history, American history. But we've never really talked about them seriously, in part because ever since Roswell, there's been a lot of fear around this topic, and the kind of military-industrial complex decided to clamp down on it and ridicule it. Either they're afraid of panic or they didn't know what they're dealing with. You've heard all the different reasons.
Right.
But they decided we're going to tell people it was weather balloons, right? And flocks of geese and Venus. And that's what's been going on for 70 years, basically. These are not Venus sightings of Venus, flocks of geese, or weather balloons. These are structured craft that people are in very close to sightings. I've often, many law enforcement officers have seen this, pilots, incredible people. I have some stories in the book from people that were Air Force pilots, so some of their sightings.
And were they, are they going on record to talk about this, or are they still, you can share my story, but just don't tell who I am?
Yeah, exactly. Right, Dave. That's it. It took, in some cases, over a year of going back and forth with these witnesses. Some of these people I knew for 20 years, and they never told me the story until recently because they were just felt it was so classified or they shouldn't be talking about it. Mainly people from the military. And you think you know people, and all of a sudden they tell you the story, and then they say, don't, you can't put it in the book. It's just between me and you. If you work with them for a while and say, listen, if I change your name, if we leave out some details, can I put it in? Right? And it took a while to get some permission from some of these people to put the stories in. And some of the permissions I never got because it's still stuff that's going on. They figure it could compromise a person who's still involved in these things, and, especially when it comes to reverse engineering, you know, of
now,
these craft.
Did any of them ever come forward and tell you, this is what happened, but there are unidentified craft, there are things like this flying in the sky, but I can tell you with 100% certainty that they are man-made and they're from our enemy?
No. Okay. No one's ever said that. Nope. It doesn't seem to be man-made. It's just not what I'm getting from any of these witnesses. Never. If it was simply that, it would slowly be declassified just like the stealth planes were, right?
Right, if it's ours. But if it's our enemies, and that's they have technology that we do not have and can't figure out, I could understand why they would keep that quiet, right? You would.
Oh, sure.
Because then you're admitting, hey, look, whoa, the Russians are kicking our ass in sky. We know that once you command the sky, you command the war. So could that be part of why they're doing it? I still believe personally that there is definitely interaction from other species, from whether it's other planets or other dimensions, parallel universes. I believe that there are craft that were not made here on Earth that are visiting our planet.
Yeah, no, I have never, I have done so much research on this, Dave, reading everything I can. The Air Force didn't conclude this either. Going all the way back to the 40s and 50s, they initially concluded it was extraterrestrial. The first, you know, project signed back at Wright-Patterson, the technicians, the best technicians they had that were used to looking at enemy aircraft and trying to figure out how they worked.
Right.
They just said, this is just too far a leap, way too far ahead of the other stuff we're getting from Russia or even that was really the only people. Not the Nazi Germany could have had some of this stuff, but that's what Wright-Patterson did, you know, the Foreign Technology Division. And those guys concluded it wasn't from Russia or Germany. It didn't leave very many other countries that could have stuff like that. This stuff is so far ahead. I mean, doing, you know, flat turns at supersonic speeds, just impossible stuff. And if those countries had had those types of weapons, they would have won World War II, right? So at least Germany would have. If Nazi Germany had had this stuff,
right,
they would have probably won. I mean, people have given different explanations of, well, maybe they were just too busy making other things. But whoever has this stuff would have clear military superiority.
Oh, yeah. If they're commanding the skies, they're commanding the war. That's without a doubt.
Soviet Union took a lot of casualties. They lost 20 million people. No one's going to do that if you have some super weapon, right?
Exactly. Now, I want to mention real quickly before I forget it. I know you're the coordinator will kill me. May 2018, there's a paranormal supernatural conference over the weekend, and there's information at facebook.com/awakenyourselffirst. So you can get information, and I'll post that up on our website here as well so that you've got it. But make sure you go check it out. Dr. Simeon Hein will be one of the speakers there, along with, I think, about 15 other really fascinating speakers on a myriad of different topics. So make sure you check that out, the May 2018 Paranormal Supernatural Conference, and that's at Awaken Yourself First on Facebook. there's all of this intrigue, and I want to bounce one question back to the first segment, and then we can continue on here. Somebody that's into remote viewing like you are, have you ever tried to remote view into an alien craft or off planet? And if so, have you been successful?
Yes. That is one of the fun things to do with RV, is to see if you can figure out what this ET enigma is, if it's really ET. I mean, the assumption there being that it's really from off planet. I'm just throwing this out, Dave, because we may not even know our own planet. Okay. Let me just throw that out there. We may not know everything that's here. There could be other civilizations here that we're not familiar with.
So you're talking about underwater and within the world.
Why not?
Have you remote viewed that?
I have not. We have remote viewed many different types of unidentified vehicles in the air. And some you can do these exercises where you trace them back to their point of origin, because the viewer is doing it blind. They don't know what they're looking at. And it does often seem to come from far away.
So if I gave you the coordinates that happened to be over O'Hara Field on the day that that UFO was seen hovering over part of O'Hara Field, if I gave you that without telling you what you're trying to link into, there's a million planes there. There's a million buildings. How would you know out of those coordinates and that specific date what it is that I'm trying to have you tune into?
Well, you would have written down on your sheet of paper, go to this specific terminal at a specific time and look, identify, describe the object over this terminal at this time. And describe this round object over the terminal and be that specific thing. That's what the viewer would lock into. And often viewers are very good at picking up anything that's out of the ordinary anyway. So they will kind of go to the strangest thing that's there. That can actually work against you, because they may go to something that's even stranger than your target. It's not the targeting isn't really an issue. They could describe it, and we didn't actually do that particular target, but we've done other things. We were given a picture of Area 51 once, Area S4. And all I did was call a viewer on the phone. I said, I have a target for you. This is a viewer in Salt Lake City who I know really well. And I said, I have a target for you. That's it. I said, I'm going to fax you the coordinates. So I faxed over the coordinates. And about a day or two later, she sends me back a session with a picture that's exactly like the picture that I'm looking at. It's just, 500 miles apart. And she drew the picture of these, Soviet MiG planes in front of the hangars at Area S4. She went inside the hangars. Once she saw hangars, she thought, okay, I'm going to look around, see what's there. And she looked around and got these flying discs, which people have said, Bob Lazar and other people have said are there. Other witnesses too. So it can be used that way. Now, going back to your question, though, really specifically, Dave, when we've sent viewers into these craft to find out what do they look like on the inside, what's going on in there, some of the viewers, I've even had this experience myself, you get the feeling like you make some contact on the inside and then you feel like you shouldn't be there. In other words, you feel like you're encountering other entities that are aware of you while you're doing the RV session,
ooh,
which is a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. So they're aware of your – do you feel – and I don't want to get too much back off onto this because I want to cover the rest of the stuff with your book. But do you feel that – are you, in a sense, are you kind of astral projecting into that spot so that there is a recognizable energy pattern to these beings? Or because many people have talked about the telepathic – connection when they've encountered aliens, do you believe that they're just picking up on the telepathic phone line you've plugged into their portal?
It's a good, really good question. I mean, generally, the way people describe RV, it's not astral projection. It could feel like that, but it's more like having a very sensitive radio tuner that can tune to lots of different signals. And it can recreate itself to feel like you're there. But I think for the most part, the feeling is it's not really like you've gone there with any part of yourself. You're just very sensitive at picking up the information. But having said that, some of these viewers did get the feeling like they were told they weren't supposed to be viewing that. They weren't supposed to be there. They were told to leave by the beings on the craft. I have some very good sessions where we viewed like there was an object seen over Mexico City in 1997, And we sent some viewers to see what it was, and they got the feeling they shouldn't be there. They were told by who was ever on there that they shouldn't be viewing it. So I don't know, I can't verify, but that's just their experience during doing the viewing session.
You realize how
it's a two-way process.
How impactful that is, because you're talking about a target from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And you're linking into this target 20 years in the past, and they are conscious of the fact that you're there. That means time is not, as we already assumed, is not linear in any form, and that if you can actually project back into time to see the site, see the and things are able to witness this encounter and tell you you're not supposed to be there, that means that you are plugging in basically to an ethereal internet database and their security protocol has fired up. That's bizarre to me to think that in time and space you're able to transfer your mind and thought and pick up on these things, and something knows that you're there at that moment. So time travel is in effect a reality.
Good point. Yeah. I mean, to correct a minor correction, we didn't do it now. We did it in 97.
Oh, shortly you did after it. Happened. Well, still, shortly after it happened.
It's still the same thing. It's still after it happened.
Right.
So you're raising a very good point. It's something that we've often wondered about. I mean, isn't RV a type of time travel in and of itself? You're viewing things in the future. Even if you're viewing things now, it's still in the past. It could have been last week, right? And nothing's instantaneous anyway, because by the time you're looking at it, it's already happened. And so it raises – David raises a lot of questions, and it does suggest that it's this vast – and this sort of gets into what I'll be talking about in the May conference a bit. It's this vast multidimensional thing, computer, internet, whatever you want to call it. And the past isn't really the past. It's happening now. Same thing with the future. It's happening now. Otherwise, you wouldn't get these interactions. Now, I can't prove that the person actually encountered the aliens on the craft and they were told to leave. Maybe they just got the feeling they shouldn't be there, and that's their interpretation. But it sort of doesn't matter. It still raises the same question of if they're viewing something that happened a week ago, a year ago, 20 years ago, and they're getting that feeling like it's happening now, does that suggest that we're in a big now moment that's differentiated into past and future, and it's all kind of a construct? I mean, this is what we're thinking about. It's a good question. Very good question.
We're here with Dr. Simeon Hein and talking about his book, Black Swan Ghosts. And this is taking us, much like the paranormal and supernatural, into many different little wormholes here, Doctor. And I love this kind of exploration. What is it like when you're dealing with these people and you're looking at it from a sociology aspect of how we are perceived when we have these experiences? Even people that are in power, people that have no power, they seem to all have this stigma and fear of the way they're going to be perceived. It doesn't matter that NASA officials, former NASA officials, astronauts, scientists, doctors, lawyers, firemen, housewives have come forward to talk about their different experiences, people are still afraid to share those experiences because of the stigma that will be attached to them. Why is that? You'd think at this point in 2017, we would be a much more open world to these possibilities and probabilities.
Yeah, you really would, wouldn't you? I mean, it's been a good time for me to be involved in this area. And it's just that there were decades of disinformation about it. So people were encouraged to avoid talking about it. And that conditioning takes a while to wear off. I mean, I'm sure younger people would probably be more open. When I talk to younger people, they're more open to the topic. Of course, there are TV shows now about it and so forth that make it more, you know, common, more acceptable in some ways, you know, to have a sighting like that. It can change really quickly, too. It doesn't mean it'll always be like that. But, yeah, people – we're afraid of being seen in a negative way, and there's a lot of people who are witnesses to these types of subjects have been treated in a very negative way. There's kind of a belligerent attitude towards them. They're either accused of making it up like a hoax, or they're accused of having some sort of schizotypal mental disorder. I mean, the DSM manual mentions belief in UFOs as part of the kind of general diagnosis of schizophrenia, which is a little amusing given some of the witnesses I talked to, the number of papers that they had peer reviewed published about all sorts of science topics, and they're talking about it too. So that it's just we don't have a lot of development in our society talking about this topic. Other countries are more open about it. You know, when I went to the citizen hearing on disclosure in 2013 in D.C. at the National Press Club, there were a number of witnesses from Latin America, from the military, who had been involved with UFOs one way or another, including pilots that had dogfights with them, with these objects. Needless to say, they couldn't shoot them down. And they told us, some of the higher ranking military officials told us, they're very open about it. In Latin America, they have conferences and they encourage people to come forward with their sightings. It takes a while to kind of turn the boat around. But in our society, it's been been an official policy to denigrate witnesses, to make fun of them. Also in the UK. This is the language that's used to describe people who've had these sorts of sightings. So it's not surprising that you get a lot of people who either they don't want to talk about it because they're afraid of the ridicule they might receive. Pilots in particular, Dave, you know this, they'll get a psych evaluation if they report UFOs. Even the case that you're talking about over O'Hare Airport a couple of years ago, right? I mean, weren't those employees told not to talk about it by United Airlines?
Right.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So pilots don't want to talk about this, even though they see these things from time to time. It's not all that common, but it happens. And then there's another layer of secrecy when you've worked in the military and you're told that what you saw has national security implications. So then you have to sign something, a non-disclosure agreement, saying that you'll never talk about it again, without even any reason or justification. And if you sign that saying you won't talk about it, I mean, it's not even talking about it with your colleagues on the airbase or anyone else you're working with. I mean, it's never again, not to your wife, not to your spouse, to anyone you work with, the other people in the Air Force unit, for example. I mean, this happened a lot when you had these Northern Tier sightings over the SAC bases, the nuclear missile bases,
right,
up north, you know, Maelstrom and Minot Air Force Base and Loring. A whole bunch of those bases in the 60s and 70s had their missile systems compromised for a while when these sightings would happen. And those guys, they're mostly guys, had to sign things saying they wouldn't talk about it, which meant you couldn't even talk about it to the repair crews that showed up later that day or the next day to try to get the missiles back online. So there was a lot of levels where this is – you're discouraged from talking about it. Now, when I talk to people nowadays who've had some sort of encounter or very good sighting there, they will say that they're afraid of losing their pension, their government pension. So this is still affecting a lot of people. And it's some issue we have to deal with. I mean, you've heard about this recent Tom DeLonge effort with his group of people who've been in the military intelligence communities.
Right.
Which he announced a couple of weeks ago. They're going to come up against this too. They want people to talk more about it. They want to have an app where people share their information. But it's going to take a lot to get people to feel comfortable with the subject after decades of misinformation, disinformation, and outright threats. I mean, if you go all the way back to Roswell, Dave, those people that were kids back then say that they were threatened by the military people that showed up. I mean, they were threatened with their lives. They said, if you ever talk about this, you know, you've heard the stories. You all will scatter your bones in the desert. You'll never be found. I mean, they talk this way to kids. So going all the way back 70 years, it's still a lot of serious fear around this subject, and we have to navigate this first, or it will remain a black swan ghost subject. Eventually, it will come out. I mean, secrets don't last forever, but that's where we are right now, in my estimate.
Well, talk to me about the credibility of people. I mean, one thing I know, we're going to have people that will email me in and say, you know, just because they're former NASA employees or high up in the ranks of the military shouldn't make them any more believable or credible, because there are nuts running many different companies and organizations, people that have mental issues and snafus. I mean, that's just that's the truth of the matter. I know personally people that are in charge of multi-million-dollar companies that are paranoid, delusional people that literally believe the world is out to screw them at every chance they get, or have seen and witnessed things that even you and I would raise an eyebrow to, Dr. Hine. So yeah. How do we start to differentiate what makes somebody more credible than another? If it, because you're driving on the back 40 in your open, you know, pickup truck and a cooler of beer in the back, does that make you any less credible than a colonel in the Air Force who saw something who may be a raging alcoholic? You know, I mean, how do we start to really, I think that's where the big problem is for most people when we're trying to differentiate why some stories are more believable than others.
Well, there's a couple answers to that. I mean, at one level, the people that are in the military are vetted, you know, mentally and physically before they're put in these very sensitive positions, especially those missile control launch officers are given these fit rep tests twice a year. I mean, you don't want someone who can launch nuclear weapons, large numbers of them, having any mental issues. So those people are some of the most highly scrutinized people on the planet in terms of mental health, physical health, any issue that would affect their ability to do their job. So we know that these are people that have already been highly examined and been deemed fit, right, to work in a very sensitive position. At another level, you often have multiple levels of evidence because when you're working in the military, you're going to have not just one person see something, you're going to have multiple people see it, and you can find other evidence to support the cases that they're talking about. In the case of Richard Hoover, who's a former NASA astrobiologist, he's in one of the chapters in the book, and he was the guy that kept finding what he felt were extraterrestrial bacteria, fossilized bacteria in meteorites. He's a specialist in exo-life and life, extreme life forms and things that can survive in volcanic vents, you know, and deep down in the ocean. And he found what he told me were very clear evidence of fossilized bacteria in meteorites, many meteorites. And NASA did not want him to talk about it. And so we know that there's other people that have talked about the fossils and meteorites. He had some other stories, too, which could also be verified. One was talking to the former head of everything that was involved with nuclear energy, nuclear missiles, nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union, someone who worked for the so-called Kurchatov Institute, was a very high-level think tank in the Soviet Union that handled anything related to nuclear issues. And this guy who ran it told him that a disc had come over one of their missile installations in the – I think it was the Carpathian Mountains and initiated the launch sequence. And they couldn't stop the missiles. And they counted all the way down to 30 seconds before it turned off. And
yeah, that's not too scary, huh?
Yeah, those missiles are pointed at us.
Oof.
So he said they pulled out every wire all the way back to Moscow, since that's where they're launched from. It's a different system than we have in the U.S., and they couldn't find anything wrong with it. But it fits all the stories of things that we had happen in the U.S. It happened here a couple times like that, too, where the launch sequences were initiated. But anyway, I was able to do more research on that case, and everything he said added up. So if you do more research and, you know, anything that happened in the military, there's going to be at least a couple people that know about it. You can find out that this person is telling one aspect of a story that's known. You're just getting another piece of the puzzle. So that's kind of some of the ways you can deal with that issue. But in general, these are people that had access to facilities that the average person wouldn't. So you would expect them to know more about this. And so it's not surprising that they do.
It's a fascinating aspect of this, and the whole idea of the way people have to hide their information. Are you ever concerned with, especially when you get somebody that we would deem more credible, giving us information that it is in fact disinformation or misinformation?
Yeah. Oh, well, there's definitely a lot of that, Dave. I mean, you never can tell when this comes from the government if it's part of a disinformation campaign or not, or it could be anybody could be part of a disinformation campaign. I mean, we know from the newer movie Unacknowledged that featured, you know, Dr. Stephen Greer.
Right.
In there. I met the director of that film, by the way, at one of these conferences recently, the SSE conference at Yale last June. Where I talked about some issues related to this, things I'll be talking about at the conference in May in Denver in 2018, multi-dimensionality, many worlds version, parallel realities, things like that. And they had a former Air Force disinformation officer on the show. I mean, he actually told them what stuff they did to try to confuse the rest of us. Can you imagine? You and I are paying for this. We're paying for people to muddy the waters in our tax dollars. And Yeah, they actually create fake stuff and they send fake things to UFO researchers. This guy, Richard Doty, said they even went up to people's homes dressed like aliens to scare them. So at night, which could be dangerous in some states.
Yes. Yeah, your conceal and carry might not be the best time to be out trying to trick people that you're a frightening alien from another galaxy. That seems like bad thoughts at this point.
He said they did. And so anyway, yeah, you always need to – you want to double check and triple check things. But some of these cases are well-known cases. For example, the case of 1986 where the Japanese airliner is flying over Alaska carrying back wine from France on its way to Tokyo, and they encounter this huge walnut-sized craft the size of an aircraft carrier told to land at Anchorage. You know, it's on radar. And John Callahan testified to this at the citizen hearing in D.C. in 2013. He was like the third down at the FAA. And he told us that the Reagan people wanted to have a meeting about it with their intelligence people and different agencies. And at the end of the meeting, they said, you know why we're so interested in this, John? We've never had half an hour of UFO footage before. Usually they just stick around for a few minutes and leave us a half hour. And they wanted the radar tapes. Well, I was able to find this is something that no one's ever heard before. This is really astounding, but I ran into someone who was working in Alaska who met a guy that had been in an Air Force base that evening in the control room, in the control room for that area. And he said that they saw this huge object next to the 747. It was vast. And that takes away any counter arguments that it was, you know, the skeptic said that the pilot saw Venus or something like this. And forget that. Here's some more corroboration. So you kind of look for corroboration on this. And it's always something to consider. You kind of have to do a judgment call yourself of why the person's telling you the story. And I have come across stories that turned out to be fake later, but I don't think any of these in the book are in that category. Mainly, Dave, because these are people that have never talked before to anybody. If they were making something up, they would have talked about it before to other people. And they'd be trying to get attention. This is the opposite. They're very reluctant to tell you the story. And you have to work with them to, you know, make sure that, you know, it's okay. I will tell you, just for the listeners, if you do go to blackswanghost.com and then look for witness videos, I put up the initial interviews I did with many of these witnesses for free. You can just watch them up there. And some of them are – these are stories you've never heard before, and they're really good. And you can make your mind – the listeners of the show should listen to these witnesses. You make your mind up whether you think these people are credible or not. I think they are, but you just make your own mind up about it. So,
in closing, what do you hope that people get from the new book?
Well, you know, the real idea is not to be so irrationally skeptical. When you encounter subjects that seem hard to believe, that's a time when you should really look at the evidence. Not everything that we hear always turns out to be true. There is disinformation, but you should really look at it and be willing to examine some of these topics, even if they're difficult, even other topics in your own life. It's really valuable to work with the most difficult topics in the long run, I think, or they're going to come back to bite you at an unexpected time. If you don't deal with them now, they will keep coming back, and eventually you'll have to deal with it when you're less able to. So it's better while you have the energy. When you hear things like this, or you have a relative who tells you about an encounter they have, you might want to sit down with them and really find out what happened. Maybe even get a little recorder and record what they're telling you if they're okay with that, and take it seriously and find time to talk to them. Because I'm just concerned there are a lot of people out there who've had experiences like this who are still haven't told anybody for one reason or another. And it's not healthy to be like that. I mean, it's better to talk about things that you've experienced, especially when it seems really far out like this. I just think it's part of our own evolution as the society and as individuals to deal with the universe, a universe where we have to admit we don't totally know what's going on. And it's healthier to be like that than to just pretend like you know everything.
I agree. It is great to catch up with you, Dr. Hein, and we'll put up a link to the book. As a matter of fact, if you go to darknessradio.com, click on the Killer Deals link. It'll take you right to our Amazon page where we've hand-selected all of the books you hear from our authors. We've also got some other great swag on there, from T-shirts to ghost hunting and Bigfoot hunting equipment and more. So you can go find it all at darknessradio.com. Click on the Killer Deals link, and we will try our best to have every one of the books that you hear mentioned on that page. And remember, every time you support our advertisers and support that page, a small portion goes to the overhead cost for our show to keep them as free of as many commercials as we can and give you a free episode every day, 5 days a week, 60 to 90 minutes long of the best in paranormal talk radio. We'll be back again tomorrow. Joining us, Anson Williams will be here. We'll talk about happy days. We'll talk about his mother's psychic and mediumistic abilities. And we're going to talk about something that is guaranteed to save some lives out there. So make sure you tune in tomorrow on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.